This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Neil Ellis. Despite years of putting up with underperforming teachers, overcrowded classrooms, and a gradually deteriorating educational experience, American students reluctantly announced today they will give the nation's public school system yet another chance this fall.
They say every year is going to get better, and it never does.
Sixth grader David Ruggles says he doesn't have much choice.
My future's at stake here.
Sixth grader Ella Johnson says she's losing patience.
I don't know. Maybe I'm being silly expecting things to change. But all I want is a good education. Is that really so much to ask?
Millions of children across the U.S. say they will, quote, probably kick themselves later.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Guys, you gotta stop. Dear listeners, we're having a little fun with you. In case you were taken in by that news story, it was completely fake, courtesy of our friends at The Onion. And we did it to illustrate a point. We've all heard news stories about failing schools. Harsh, depressing, hopeless. But does it really have to be that way? On this episode of the TED Radio Hour, we're talking about how to build a better classroom. And we're looking to a few TED speakers to help show the way to an education revolution. TED brings together dynamic thinkers from all areas of expertise and study and gives them the opportunity to give the talk of their lives. One of the most popular TED Talks was given by Sir Ken Robinson.
Mind you, my daughter pointed me to a short video on YouTube. It's 90 seconds long of two kittens having a chat. And that's been downloaded 60 million times, you know, so I'm not getting carried away.
He's a cultural leader who's thought a lot about the significance of creativity in the education system and the economy.
It's been great, hasn't it? I've been blown away by the whole thing. In fact, I'm leaving.
Of course, Ken did stay. His talk looked beyond surface reform and got to the heart of a more systemic problem in education.
The big idea behind the TED Talk, because you only have 18 minutes, so you have to focus on something, is an idea that's preoccupied me for a very long time, which is the ways in which schools tend to inhibit creativity in general and individual talents in particular. There's a terrible tendency to confuse raising standards with standardizing. In my experience, if you personalize education, if you customize it, if you engage children's imaginations or students at any age, you get much higher results, much deeper commitment, and a far more resilient process of education.
I find this very interesting. If you're at a dinner party and you say you work in education, you can see the blood run from their face. They think, oh my God, you know, why me? It's my one night out all week. But if you ask people about their education, they pin you to the wall. Because it's one of those things that goes deep with people. Am I right? Like religion and money and other things. So I have a big interest in education, and I think we all do. We have a huge vested interest in it, partly because it's education that's meant to take us into this future that we can't grasp. If you think of it, children starting school this year will be retiring in 2065. Nobody has a clue, despite all the expertise that's been on parade for the past 4 days, what the world will look like in 5 years' time. And yet we're meant to be educating them for it. So the unpredictability, I think, is extraordinary. My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. Thank you. That was it, by the way. Thank you very much.
When you say creativity in the educational format, what do you mean? And when you say literacy, what do you mean?
Well, creativity is probably the most fundamental set of capacities that distinguishes as human beings. And from it flows a whole range of practical capacities that we call creativity. I define it very particularly as the process of having original ideas that have value. And everything that's distinctive about human culture, the fact we're speaking thousands of miles apart across these extraordinary technologies, the fact we're in buildings at all, the fact that people can listen to it, science, technology, the arts, music, languages, they all grow from this tremendously fertile power we have to imagine and to create things. So when I say it's fundamental, it predates literacy. It's absolutely at the heart of what it is to be a human being. And there are lots of misconceptions about it. People think they're not creative because they think it's only about the arts. I'm a staunch advocate of the arts in education. But this isn't just about the arts. I think it's a catastrophe when arts programs are cut from schools. But you can be creative in science, in maths, in technology, in history, in anything that really that's touched by human intelligence. And literacy is a great example of the extraordinary flowering of human intelligence, the ability to record thoughts and to respond to them, to understand them, to interpret them. The parallel, I think, is this, that creativity encompasses great literacy. And I ran a large commission in the UK a number of years ago, and I remember the Secretary of State saying, you know, creativity is very important, but we need to promote literacy first. And it seems to me that's a complete misunderstanding. It's like saying, we'll bake the cake, and if it's nice enough, we'll put the eggs in afterwards. Because one of the ways you get kids to read and write and to be interested in these cultural processes is to fire up their imaginations, give them interesting stuff to read, give them challenge things to write. These aren't opposites. They're complementary processes that help to define what it is to be a human being.
You tell this great story about the little girl who draws a picture of God.
I had a great story recently, I love telling it, of a little girl who was in a drawing lesson. She was six, and she was at the back drawing, and the teacher said, this little girl hardly ever paid attention. And in this drawing lesson, she did. And the teacher was fascinated. She went over to her, and she said, what are you drawing? And the girl said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher said, but nobody knows what God looks like. And the girl said, they will in a minute. Okay. Kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative. What we do know is if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. And the result is that we are educating people out of their creative capacities.
At what point in that little girl's educational life, Ken, do you think she would not have given that answer? At what age, grade level, would that have been taught out of her?
It's hard to put an exact date on it. And it's not only, I should say, the culture standardized testing. Other things factor in. Now, one of them is that children reach a certain age, you know, maybe 7, 8, sometimes earlier, where they start to become self-conscious. They might draw freely or sing freely or make music freely, but then they become aware of other people's judgments of them. They become aware of other standards out in the field, and they start to think, well, I'm not as good as that, or I can't do that. And so they start, in any case, sometimes to be a bit inhibited. But it's also because there reaches a point in all of our development where, so to speak, our ambitions outrun our ability. You know, we can't quite do what we'd like to be able to do. But then that gets compounded, that's my point, in schools, where the whole emphasis is on the one right answer, where imaginative thinking is actively discouraged, where this culture of standardized testing and conformity effectively stifles creative thinking in every field. If you're promoting an education where there's only one right answer and don't look, it's in the back, and if you get it wrong, you're in trouble, that's hardly a good climate for cultivating the powers of creativity and innovation. And it really matters that we should. That's my point. This isn't a trivial argument. I think this is a really strategic and fundamental argument.
Our education system is predicated on the idea of academic ability. And there's a reason. The whole system was invented around the world. There were no public systems of education really before the 19th century. They all came into being to meet the needs of industrialism. So the hierarchy is rooted on two ideas. Number one, that the most useful subjects for work are at the top. So you were probably steered benignly away from things at school when you were a kid, things you liked, on the grounds you would never get a job doing that. Is that right? Don't do music, you're not going to be a musician. Don't do art, you won't be an artist. Benign advice. Now, profoundly mistaken. The whole world is engulfed in a revolution. And the second is academic ability, which has really come to dominate our view of intelligence because the universities designed the system in their image. If you think of it, the whole system of public education around the world is a protracted process of university entrance. And the consequence is that many highly talented, brilliant, creative people think they're not because the thing they were good at school wasn't valued or was actually stigmatized. And I think we can't afford to go on that way.
In your talk, you ask the audience to remember that what intelligence really is, and you offer three ideas.
About intelligence. One, it's diverse. Secondly, intelligence is dynamic. And the third thing about intelligence is it's distinct.
Tell me a little bit why each one is important.
So one of the problems is that in education, there's this rather narrow view of academic ability. And academic ability is important, but it's a very particular sort of activity. It's a capacity for a certain type of critical reasoning. It's why kids spend so much time in school writing essays and doing low-level clerical work. The thing is, though, the human intelligence is much more expansive than that. You know, we have a capacity for architecture, for practical things, for making, for cuisine, for music, for applied science, for business. You know, the whole rich diversity of human culture is an expression of the fact that intelligence itself is so diverse. So the diversity of intelligence to me is terribly important because our schools, by narrowing the curriculum, ostracize whole areas of children's intelligence, and some children whose intelligence only shows itself in that way end up being marginalized and distressed by it. Intelligence is highly dynamic. Yes, it's interactive. You know, the human brain is intensely interactive, and most of what happens to move the world forward comes from people making connections between different ways of thinking across borders, across disciplines. Schools tend to frustrate the principle of dynamism because they become rigidly organized into separate subjects and into age groups. And it's highly distinct. And I was saying this recently, you know, that every one of us is a unique moment in the whole of human history. And there's never been anybody like you before. There won't be anybody like you again. Nobody will ever have your life again. In schools, though, with the emphasis on conformity and standardization, all these individual differences get bleached out. And it's why so many kids end up dropping out of school or withdrawing from it emotionally. So those three things, the diversity, dynamism, and uniqueness of human intelligence, are to me at the heart of the kind of education systems we should have. And they also represent, to some extent, the dynamics of creativity.
This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
So as I was saying...
That's Sir Ken Robinson, a world-renowned expert on education and innovation. We've been discussing how creativity is often suffocated in the classroom, and it's not just the arts. Ken says people can be creative in math and science, and he cautions against dismissing students' natural interests, even if they don't have a thing to do with formal education. Here's Ken in his second TED Talk he gave in 2010. He tells the story about meeting a man who thankfully ignored his teacher. You'll see why.
I was up in San Francisco a while ago doing a book signing. There was this guy buying a book. He was in his 30s, and I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a fireman." And I said, "How long have you been a fireman?" He said, "Always. I've always been a fireman." And I said, "Well, when did you decide?" He said, "As a kid." He said, "Actually, it was a problem for me at school, because at school, everybody wanted to be a fireman." He said, "I wanted to be a fireman, you know." And he said, "When I got to the senior year of school, my teachers didn't take it seriously. This one teacher didn't take it seriously. He said, I was throwing my life away if that's all I chose to do with it. That I should go to college, I should become a professional person, I had great potential, and I was wasting my talent to do that." And he said it was humiliating because he said it in front of the whole class, and I really felt dreadful. But it's what I wanted. And as soon as I left school, I applied to the fire service and I was accepted. And he said, "You know, I was thinking about that guy recently, just a few minutes ago when you were speaking about this teacher." He said, "Because 6 months ago, I saved his life." He said he was in a car wreck, and I pulled him out, gave him CPR, and I saved his wife's life as well. He said, "I think he thinks better of me now." You know what I mean? Human communities depend upon a diversity of talent, not a singular conception of ability. And at the heart of our challenges, at the heart of the challenge is to reconstitute our sense of ability and of intelligence. This linearity thing is a problem. When I arrived in LA about 9 years ago, I came across a policy statement, very well intentioned, which said college begins in kindergarten. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. If we had time, I could go into this, but we don't. Kindergarten begins in kindergarten. A friend of mine once said, you know, a three-year-old is not half a six-year-old.
There's an interesting point you make in your talk that maybe the college degree really isn't worth what it used to be worth, and that in terms of education, if you went to college once upon a time, that was really something. Like you going to college. And now the way that our education system is in some ways, it just seems like another four-year receptacle.
It's a point I'm very keen to emphasize, that we've become obsessed with college. And I don't mean to say that you shouldn't go to college or you shouldn't encourage your kids to go to college if they want to go. But it's become almost uncritically accepted as the natural thing that happens after high school, that you have to go to college. And if you don't go to college, you've somehow lost the game. And in the meantime, the obsession with college is demeaning all the other routes into working life. We've created this ridiculous situation where we prioritize academic work over what we call vocational programs. You know, if you're going into a practical working role, you know, whatever it is, you might want to be a chef or you might want to do social work. You know, you can name them. All the myriad activities on which a healthy community depends tend to be demeaned by this obsession with getting kids to the Ivy League. And the assumption is that if you get to the Ivy League, you won, and everybody else, they're all also rans. So the result of it is we have this kind of apartheid in education as well, which is unjustified and eventually, I think, catastrophic. So I'm not saying we shouldn't send kids to college, but I think parents should at least pause and ask, and kids should ask, is this the right thing for me right now? Do I know why I'm going? Do I need to go immediately? Or maybe I'll go and work for a few years, and then by then I might know why I want to be there. I talk to a lot of graduate students, you know, and they say, I wish I'd gone to college later, because if I'd gone in my late 20s, I would have understood why I was there and I would have got more from it. I meet all kinds of people who don't enjoy what they do. They simply go through their lives getting on with it. They get no great pleasure from what they do. They endure it rather than enjoy it and wait for the weekend. But I also meet people who love what they do and couldn't imagine doing anything else. If you said to them, don't do this anymore, they'd wonder what you're talking about. Because it isn't what they do, it's who they are. They say, but this is me. You know, it would be foolish for me to abandon this because it speaks to my most authentic self. And it's not true of enough people. In fact, on the contrary, I think it's still true of a minority of people. And I think there are many possible explanations for it. And high among them is education. Because education, in a way, dislocates very many people from their natural talents. And human resources are like natural resources. They're often buried deep. You have to go looking for them. They're not just lying around on the surface. You have to create the circumstances where they show themselves. And you might imagine education would be the way that happens, but too often, it's not. Every education system in the world is being reformed at the moment, and it's not enough. Reform is no use anymore, because that's simply improving a broken model. What we need, and the word's been used many times during the course of the past few days, is not evolution, but a revolution in education. This has to be transformed into something else.
Ken, what would that something else look like?
I think we need to move from an industrial model of education to a much more personalized form of education. The culture of education is like an industrial model. It's like a factory. If you look at it, you know, we still educate people by age groups as if the most important thing they had in common is how old they were. We divide the day up into 40-minute bits and ring bells in between. We divide subjects from each other. So it's an industrial model which inherently promotes conformity. And my argument is that all of that may have worked for the industrial economy, but there are big reasons to change it. One of them is economic. The world is changing faster than ever. And America, for example, depends upon now a really strong base of innovation. IBM published a report recently where they interviewed 3,000 CEOs of companies across the whole world, and they all said that their top priority is how to promote companies that are creative. this is the big irony, I think, in all of this, that the emphasis on conformity in education is there of, because of what politicians often think are the needs of the economy. But if you speak to people in business, as I do a lot, all they want to talk about is innovation and creativity. And they say, we're getting all these kids coming from colleges, highly qualified, but they can't think differently and they can't work in teams anymore because they've been homogenized by their education. But in the end, all education is personal. It was for you, it was for me, it is for everybody who goes through it. We need an education system that's sensitive and which is tuned into how people think and how they work best, what their own learning styles might be. So the schools of the future, I mean, I think we have to go back to having a much broader curriculum. We have to give equal weight to the arts, to the sciences, to humanities, physical education, math and science. They're all equally important, not more or less important. I think we need to redefine learning communities. Some people choose to educate their kids at home now and do a very good job of it. But you do want a greater flexibility of choice. That's my point. So that's why I think we need a revolution. It's not just a question of hand-polishing bits of the current system. We really need to rethink some of the fundamentals of the system.
We have to recognize that human flourishing is not a mechanical process. It's an organic process. And you cannot predict the outcome of human development. All you can do is, like a farmer, is create the conditions under which they will begin to flourish. So when we look at reforming education and transforming it, it isn't like cloning a system. It's about customizing them to your circumstances and personalizing education to the people that you're actually teaching. And doing that, I think, is the answer to the future, because it's not about scaling a new solution. It's about creating a movement in education in which people develop their own solutions, but with external support based on a personalized curriculum. Now, in this room, there are people who represent extraordinary resources in business, in multimedia, in the internet. These technologies, combined with extraordinary talents of teachers, provide an opportunity to revolutionize education. And I urge you to get involved in it, because it's vital not just to ourselves, but to the future of our children. Thank you.
Ken Robinson, thanks for being on the TED Radio Hour.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Sir Ken Robinson. He's author of the book, The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. To watch both of Ken's TED Talks and others on the intersection of creativity and education, go to TED.com.
So notice, X year is a variable. X year.
What if you had a teacher? You could pause, rewind,
negative 2 to the third power,
and replay whenever you really needed to,
which is negative 8.
Salman Khan is that teacher. He's the founder of the Khan Academy. It's an online library of more than 3,000 instructional videos teaching concepts of math, science, and the humanities. Its website gets about 4.7 million visitors per month. And the formula for a lesson is pretty simple.
You hear my voice and you see what I'm drawing in these kind of pastel chalk-like colors on this black background.
Sal never set out to work in the education field. He actually used to be a hedge fund analyst. And those first couple of instructional videos were really only meant for his cousins he was remotely tutoring. He told the story at TED in 2011.
And as soon as I put those first YouTube videos up, something interesting happened. Actually, a bunch of interesting things happened. The first was the feedback from my cousins. They told me that they preferred me on YouTube than in person. Once you get over the backhanded nature of that, there was actually something very profound there. They were saying that they preferred the automated version of their cousin to their cousin. You have this situation where now they can pause and repeat their cousin. If they have to review something that they should have learned a couple of weeks ago or maybe a couple of years ago, they don't have to be embarrassed and ask their cousin. They can just watch those videos. If they're bored, they can go ahead. They can watch it at their own time, at their own pace. The other thing that happened is, you know, I put them on YouTube and then people started stumbling on it. And I started getting some comments and some letters and kind of feedback from random people around the world. And this is actually from one of the original calculus videos. And someone wrote just on YouTube, it was a YouTube comment. I actually got a natural high and a good mood for the entire day. Since I remember seeing all of this Matrix text in class, and here I'm all like, I know Kung Fu. And we got a lot of feedback along those lines. You know, it's clearly it was helping people. But I didn't think it would be something that would somehow penetrate the classroom. But then I started getting letters from teachers. And the teachers would write saying, we've used your videos to flip the classroom. You've given the lectures. So now what we do, and this could actually happen in every classroom in America tomorrow, what I do is I assign the lectures for homework, and what used to be homework, I now have the students doing in the classroom. By removing the one-size-fits-all lecture from the classroom and letting students have a self-paced lecture at home, and then when you go to the classroom, letting them do work, having the teacher walk around, having the peers actually be able to interact with each other, these teachers have used technology to humanize the classroom.
We're talking to Sal Khan about a way to use video to reinvent education. He's the founder of the Khan Academy. And I think I know the answer to this, but I want to ask you, so many teachers have pressure to get kids to just memorize and the material and pass a test by a certain date. They have to teach to the test. Does your model take into account these time constraints and what teachers have to face, the reality of teaching to the test?
We're trying to. I think that gets actually to the core of the issue. That whole dynamic that you're describing is a byproduct of our education model, which I think very few people have really confronted properly. The education model is we group kids into these age-based cohorts, and then we move them together. Even when kids clearly have substandard understanding of one concept or another, they got a B or a C or a D on some exam, they don't know how to multiply decimals or whatever, you say, oh, too bad, your cohort is moving ahead, let's all move together. And so what we fix is the calendar and how long students have to learn something. And what's variable is how well they learn it. And as they go further and further through their mathematical, or it's actually true of any subject, they have all of these gaps. And as you have more and more of these gaps, in order for the teachers to get you through the next hurdle, they have to make it more memorization based. And so what we say is, no, let's just do the opposite. Since we now have the tools to let every student work at their own pace, we don't have to have this kind of assembly line model anymore. Let students build their foundations, master concepts for the most part before moving on, so they never hit that wall. So what we're saying is, instead of holding fixed when and how students learn it, and the variable is how well they learn it, we want to hold fixed that the students have a high level of mastery, and the variable is how long they have to learn it and when they learn it.
I know Bill Gates is a good guy, and he's trying to work towards making education better. And I know he was a big fan of your videos. And I remember him saying, you know, my kids watch these videos. And for a moment, I thought, hey, Bill Gates, you can afford the best tutors in the world for your kids. This is not for you. There's an egalitarian aspect about this that levels the playing field for kids who can't afford a really expensive tutor or even a good tutor. And here you are in your videos, and you are their sort of fairy godtutor. I just wondered, did you ever think about the egalitarian aspect of what you were doing?
You know, that was the point from day one of setting it up as a not-for-profit. You know, obviously, once the video is made, the cost of delivering that video to an incremental student is pretty close to zero. And if you could somehow empower a life for pretty much zero, I think one should. And so that's why our mission statement, you know, in 2007, it was somewhat delusional. I was literally working out of a closet then, but I said, you know, a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere. So that's always been core. But I think, you know, the point you bring out, Bill Gates, has actually been incredibly powerful, because I think in the past, when people have tried to reform education or do things that are egalitarian, they've created these solutions that are directed at the poor, and they really weren't taken up by the middle class or the upper middle class or the affluent in Bill Gates's case. And the signal that tells the poor is, okay, this is a solution for you, but not for the rich kids.
And
I think anyone who has a rational brain says, well, I'm suspicious of it. If you're saying it's so good, how come Bill Gates isn't using it? How come the kids on the other side of the railroad tracks aren't using it? So when Bill Gates said that he uses this free thing, even when he could have obviously afforded anything, it was a huge signal to parents and students everywhere that, wow, this is worth my time.
There's no reason why you can't have that peer-to-peer tutoring beyond that one classroom. Imagine what happens if that student in Calcutta all of a sudden can tutor your son, or your son can tutor that kid in Calcutta. And I think what you'll see emerging is this notion of a global one-world classroom. And that's essentially what we're trying to build. Thank you.
Sal Khan of the Khan Academy. Thanks for being on the TED Radio Hour. Good luck to you.
Thanks a bunch.
You can find out more about the Khan Academy and maybe brush up on some algebra while you're at it. Go to ted.npr.org. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. In John Hunter's fourth grade class, the students aren't tied down to their desks.
All right, we're going into negotiation as of now.
I say to the students every day when we start class, I'm sorry, boys and girls, I'm afraid we're going to have fun today.
Back in the late 70s, John created a hands-on political simulation called the World Peace Game, and it's been a part of his classroom ever since.
Gaby has given me a promise that he did go and buy those troops secretly. And I believe he's trying to arm the World Bank and try to get everyone mixed up.
Fourth graders become prime ministers, secretaries of state, and are asked to solve problems typically reserved for the adult leaders of the world.
We have, ethnic and minority tensions. We have chemical and nuclear spills, nuclear proliferation. There's oil spills, environmental disasters, water rights disputes, breakaway republics, famine, endangered species, and global warming. If Al Gore is here, I'm going to send my fourth graders from Agna Hurt and Venable School to you because they solve global warming in a week.
John Hunter got the chance to explain more about his game at TED in 2011. And he's with me now. John, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
What is the World Peace Game, John?
Oh, my goodness. It's been called a geopolitical simulation or exercise, and it's a gigantic, towering plexiglass structure with thousands of game pieces on four different levels, and I'm sure you can hear in the talk how complex it is, and it's deliberately complex, putting students in situations as world leaders, arms dealers, United Nations bodies, and they're charged with solving the bigger, the larger problems of the world, and they're trying to do without combat if possible. They use Sun Tzu's The Art of War to try and see how not to go through those activities. But, of course, in the game, the rules are so open, they're allowed to do whatever they can conceive and can understand the consequences of. They can act that way, and they sometimes learn by doing, and sometimes they learn by choosing another path. And that allowance, that open space to make that kind of choice, I think is the strength of the game, really.
If you look on the World Peace Game map, he has like that much oil.
So does Caden. And Caden's our complete ally.
But you know what it really boils down to? The game is actually just a pretext for fostering critical and creative thinking in children and fostering that effort that they make to design their own tools to solve problems. And hopefully they carry that with them as they leave and go further into the world. And, you know, I used to be asked, what's the purpose of the game? And I'd say something educational. And now I say it's really to decrease suffering and to increase the opportunity for compassion.
John, your story was made into a documentary called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, a great title. And, you know, you used a little bit of it in your TED talk, and I watched the documentary. And one of the things that is so interesting about it is, at times, it appears a little bit chaotic, but in the good way. Is it as chaotic when those kids all of a sudden find themselves to be prime ministers and arms dealers?
You're very kind to say chaotic in a very good way. Yes, and it's designed to allow that much confusion and complexity to go on. And in a way, it mirrors life. Life is not always neat and orderly. We like for it to be so. So we try to emulate that situation and give students a safe opportunity to work on problems of that intensity at a much lower magnitude. But they take those roles on so seriously, and suddenly they seem to become bigger than themselves because they have then a responsibility for their people. And ultimately, as we go through the game, about midway through, there's a sort of a clicking point where they realize that they have responsibility for everyone, not just their own group or their own selves. And that's really the magic of it, is when that non-preaching or non-teaching about compassion is evidenced through their actual experience in the game, where they learn that they are stewards and caretakers of everyone, just in practice, really.
We had played the game one session after school for many weeks, about 7 weeks, and we had essentially solved all 50 of the interlocking crises. The way the game is won is all 50 problems have to be solved. Every country's asset value has to be increased above its starting point. Some are poor, some are wealthy, there are billions. A World Bank president was a third grader one time. He said, how many zeros in a trillion? I gotta calculate that right away. But he was setting fiscal policy in that game for high school players who were playing with him. So the team that was the poorest had gotten even poorer. There was no way they could win. We were approaching 4 o'clock, our cutoff time. There was about a minute left. And despair just settled over the room. I thought, I'm failing as a teacher. I should have gotten it so they could have won. I should have brought them to they shouldn't be failing like this. I've failed them. And I was just feeling so sad and dejected. And suddenly, Brendan walked over to my chair and he grabbed the bell I rang to signal a change or reconvening of cabinets. He ran back to his seat, rang the bell. Everybody ran to his chair. There was screaming. There was yelling, waving of their dossiers. They get these dossiers full of secret documents. They were gesticulating. They were running around. I didn't know what they were doing. I'd lost control of my classroom. Principal walks in. I'm out of a job. The parents are looking in the window. And Brennan runs back to his seat. Everybody runs back to their seat. He rings the bell again. He says, we have, and there's 12 seconds left on the clock. We have all nations pooled all our funds together. And we've got $600 billion. We're going to offer as a donation to this poor country. And if they accept it, it'll raise their asset value and they can win the game. Will you accept it? And there are 3 seconds left on the clock. Everybody looks at this prime minister of that country. And he says, yes. And the game is won. Spontaneous compassion that could not be planned for, that was unexpected and unpredictable.
You've talked a lot about what the World Peace Game has done for your students. How has it changed you as a teacher?
What it does is it first of all, shows me my arrogance and my uninsightfulness, because I will have created a crisis where there's actually some trace of my own baggage, my own prejudice in there, and the students will explode that. They will see that, understand this crisis doesn't make sense. It's a little skewed, Mr. Hunter. So I'll have to rewrite it, come up with another approach. And so often I'm basically getting a great reflection on my own practice, how I need to improve as a teacher through their efforts in the game, their practice, what they reveal, what they show. And every time we play, I do not know what they're going to do. The game is designed that way. It's designed to fail massively, and they have to come out of that somehow.
They won't let. They say I can't withdraw that. And since I'm withdrawing, they're going to attack.
What did the UN say?
They said it was fine, but they say I can't withdraw the
answer. No, the UN says it's fine. It's fine. This is very good. You do what you want to do. The UN sanctions it. You're okay. Think of the consequences and deal with them in a good way.
I have good news for you, Amelia. What?
And so our relationship together, they know we can trust each other, and they know I'm going to help them and not let them flounder too long if I can help it, but really they have to put it together themselves. And so that relationship is really the thing that holds us together. And I'm in the dark. I have a motto. I sort of go by slogan. I go by with the game. It's learning to live and work comfortably in the unknown. And I'm in the unknown from the moment I step in the classroom. And I almost have to be, I think, to be a good teacher. If it's all drawn out in a script, there's no creativity, there's no life in it. And the students know that too.
Actually, I can't tell them anything because I don't know the answer, and I admit the truth to them right up front. I don't know. And because I don't know, they've got to dig up the answer. And so I apologize to them as well. I say, I'm so sorry, boys and girls, but the truth is we have left this world to you in such a sad and terrible shape. We hope you can fix it for us, and maybe this game will help you learn how to do it.
We're speaking with John Hunter, who teaches fourth grade in Virginia, about a unique experience he's brought to his classroom called the World Peace Game. And John, you make a joke about how your students have solved global warming a couple of different times. What were the solutions?
Well, yeah, I don't want to give too much away because we have teams who've yet to play, but I can sort of hint a little bit. They deal with climate change in different ways. Sometimes they use a technological approach. They sometimes go the green route with more plantings on a vast scale to replace wetlands and rainforests and so forth that have been lost on the planet. So there are a number of different approaches, actually, and I've seen it happen ever since we put that crisis in, I think about 8 years ago. Every time we play, the students have to deal with that now. And that's coupled with about 49 other problems, including water rights issues and territorial border disputes and religious and ethnic problems and so forth. So it's all intermixed. The problems are interlocked. You can't simply think in terms of one problem alone, as we really can in the world as adults. And they practice this kind of interdependent, interrelated thinking. Hopefully it's a tool that lasts through practice like that.
There's a clip I want to play from your TED Talk that is this amazing story about this little girl who had a vision. And at the time, you all thought she had just gone bonkers.
In this game, we had a little girl, and she was the defense minister of the poorest nation. And defense minister, she had a tank corps and air force and so forth. And she was next door to a very wealthy, oil-rich neighbor. Without provocation, suddenly she attacked, against her prime minister's orders, the next-door neighbor's oil field. She marched into the oil field reserves, surrounded it without firing a shot, and secured it and held it. And that neighbor was unable to conduct any military operations because their fuel supply was locked up. We were all upset with her. Why are you doing this? This is the world peace game. What is wrong with you? It's a little girl. And 9 years old, she held her peace and said, I know what I'm doing. I mean, to her girlfriend, she said that. You know, that's a kind of a breach there. And we learned in this, you don't really ever want to cross a 9-year-old girl with tanks. They are the toughest opponents. And we were very upset. I thought I was failing as a teacher. Why would she do this? But come to find out, a few game days later, there were turns where we take a negotiation from a team. Then we actually, there's a negotiation period with all teams, and each team takes a turn. Then we go back in a negotiation round and round. So each turn around is one game day. So a few game days later, it came to light that we found out this major country was planning a military offensive and to dominate the entire world. Had they had their fuel supplies, they would have done it. She was able to see the vectors and trend lines and intentions long before any of us, and understand what was going to happen and made a philosophical decision to attack in a peace game. Now, she used a small war to avert a larger war, so we stopped and had a very good philosophical discussion about whether that was right, conditional good, or not right. That's the kind of thinking that we put them in the situation. I could not have designed that in teaching. It came about spontaneously through their collective wisdom.
And one of the more sober experiences the students have is that if someone is killed, they're required to write a letter to that person's family.
Yeah, that was a fairly recent innovation. What happened was, I guess I had contact with veterans coming back from Desert Storm and even Afghanistan and Iraq. And, of course, I want to protect my children. I don't want them exposed to frightening and awful things. But I also want to get across the idea that, you know, a commitment like that, even in a game, does have a cause. And so what I asked them to do is to write a letter to the fictional parents of their troops if they lose in battle. And I asked them to explain what happened, asked them to explain why it happened, and then to offer some words to the parents to help them hopefully understand. And it's a very moving thing. As students, I think it doesn't go quite as deep for them. It is a game still. But if there are adults in the room, I think it really does hit home what we're asking of the students and what kind of range we're trying to bring about for the student understanding, at least planting the seed for that kind of consideration in the future.
We had this situation come up last summer, actually, at Agnew Hurt School in Albemarle County, and one of our military commanders got up to read that letter, and one of the kids said, Mr. Hunter, let's ask, there's a parent over there, it was a parent visiting that day, just sitting in the back of the room, let's ask that mom to read the letter. It'll be more realer if she reads it. So we did. We asked her, and she gamely picked up the letter. Sure. She started reading. She read one sentence. She read two sentences. By the third sentence, she was in tears. I was in tears. Everybody understood that when we lose somebody, the winners are not gloating. We all lose.
You're in a really unique position because you've given this experience to your students for over 30 years now. Have you noticed any differences in the way students have played or play the game over the past 30 years?
Yes, I would say so. Back in the beginning, students were more apt or more ready to commit to combat and warfare. Mm. They seemed to enjoy the challenge and going at it that way. And it may have been media influence. It may have been our culture at the time. This was in the late 1970s, 78, 79, when we started. So I think in the 80s there was that attitude, at least especially among the young men, the young boys. They were more than apt to attack first and ask questions later. And what I've noticed over time is that there's a greater reluctance to engage in combat first. There's more thinking, more thoughtfulness, more exploring alternatives. And I say particularly my girls, they have always been, I think, a little bit more consensus-oriented in my classes that I've seen. But I think the leadership capability is more apparent now than ever before, that the girls are not hesitant to step up and take leadership positions, and that negotiation skills that some of them bring to the job are great for the game and great for everybody playing. So those kinds of changes I have seen occur over the years.
What happens when the game is over? Do you have a debrief with the kids? And what's their reaction when it's all done?
Oh, yeah. We spend a week or longer. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a number of questions, essay questions, open-ended questions that I have prepared for them to wrestle with. And things come up in the questionnaire like, what makes a good negotiator? Or can you have peace while having violence? I mean, it's very philosophical, tough questions that they have just wrestled with. And so they have a greater depth of understanding, and the insight's just phenomenal. And I find that that's true because I have students who come up 10, 20, 30 years later, Allison, who let me know they remember something I've completely forgotten that happened in the game and how that affected their lives, even down to the choice of the career they've gone into. So that kind of effect, that kind of resonance is startling to me, and it's very gratifying. And I feel like as a teacher, you're reaching through time. You're making an effect here in this room today that you're not even aware of. And yet, decades later, maybe even generations later, the effect can become apparent. So it's a very huge responsibility you can feel as an educator that way.
In view of all the crises being solved, and in view of everyone's asset value being over 100 billion, I hereby declare this World Peace Game won!
Every game we play is different. Some games are more about social issues, some are more about economic issues, some games are more about warfare. But I don't try and deny them that reality of being human. I allow them to go there and through their own experience learn in a bloodless way how not to do what they consider to be the wrong thing, and they find out what is right their own way, their own selves. And so in this game, I've learned so much from it, but I would say that if only they could pick up a critical thinking tool or a creative thinking tool from this game and leverage something good for the world, they may save us all. If only. And on behalf of all of my teachers on whose shoulders I'm standing, thank you. Thank you.
John Hunter, thank you so much for joining us in the TED Radio Hour.
Oh, Allison, what a pleasure. Thank you, and you're most welcome.
John Hunter. He's a fourth grade teacher from Charlottesville, Virginia, and subject of the documentary World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. You can find out more about the film. Go to our website, ted.npr.org. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, and Sam Greenspan. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. Also, thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.